including children, have also been injured in fresh attacks across Gaza. Reports also indicate that Israeli tanks opened heavy fire, targeting eastern neighborhoods of Gaza City. In northern Gaza, the regime forces detonated and demolished homes in Jabalia. Since the ceasefire took effect, more than 340 Palestinians have been killed in the regime's strikes. Israel's violations of the truce continue amid harsh humanitarian conditions. A report by Gaza Media Office says nearly 42% of Gaza's population receives no meal per day. Well, now joining us with the latest from Deir al-Balah is our correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim. Ghada, as always, thank you very much for joining us. I mean, definitely the winter is there, hitting hard in the Palestinian territory, the Gaza territory there. Other than these continued violations, of course, the rain seems to not be making the dire humanitarian situation even any easier. What updates do you have for us there, Ghada?
Yes, exactly. And since the last night until now, the rain has never stopped. It was really heavily pouring in all the areas of the Gaza Strip, which actually causes a flooding in the areas like Al-Bawasi and across the tents of the people who are in sheltering inside these tents encampments in the south of the Strip, in the west of the Gaza Strip. Again, these people, according to UNRWA, around 1 million Palestinians are still displaced in these sheltering and in these very worn and tattered tents in the western parts of the Gaza Strip, lacking all the essentials of life and lacking the sheltering materials. And every time it rains, it is another reminder that these people are enduring another harsh reality and another unimaginable suffering because of the rain and because of the floods that are completely flooding their tents, and because of the mud that is penetrating the tents and the ground beneath them. So the suffering is continuous. They are not only suffering the displacement and the unimaginable lack of all the basics of survival, but also they are lacking the sheltering materials, and the suffering is multiplied as they don't have sheltering materials, and they are actually enduring another harsh winter, or the third harsh winter since the beginning of this genocide. This suffering did not end, actually, by the announcement of the ceasefire. However, they are still continuously living every passing day on the hope that they might have their an end of their suffering. They might have they have the sheltering materials allowed to alleviate the suffering they have been living since the beginning of the war. And amidst all this, the Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement are continuous in the shape of the Israeli attack on all the areas of the Gaza Strip from the north to the south behind the so-called yellow line. This morning, a man was killed in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City, Beni Sahela area, and that actually was as a result of an Israeli attack that targeted a gathering of people in Beni Sahela. And this is very repeated, very recurrent since yesterday until now. Five people were killed, four were killed yesterday, two of them were killed in Al-Qarara area, two others were killed in the north of the Gaza Strip, one in Beit Lahia and the other in At-Tufah neighborhood. This is again a stark reminder of how fragile this ceasefire is since its beginning, since the 10th of October until now. The ceasefire is actually bringing more bloodshed to the population here. Every passing day carries more suffering and carries more bloodshed to the population, and that actually is telling much about how most of the people in the Gaza Strip nowadays feeling disappointment about this ceasefire. It is not bringing any relief to the population, and it is only increasing their suffering as Israeli restrictions are continuous and the Israeli ban on entry of all the life-saving materials is continuous. Until this moment, we are having at least 16,500 Palestinian patients and injuries still suffering in Gaza hospitals, unable to get any medical evacuation to be treated outside the hospitals of the Gaza Strip. And in the meantime, unable to get the medical supplies they are promised to get as the ceasefire went into effect previously. So these people are stuck in the hospitals of Gaza.
Yes,
as Israeli occupation is banning the entry of medical supplies, the suffering is continuous for most of the population here.
Well, on that point, I'd like to thank you, as always, there for joining us. Our correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim, joining us from Deir al-Balah. Please stay safe and stay warm. Well, the Hamas resistance movement has called on international courts to prosecute those behind the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation for committing crimes against the Palestinian people. Hamas made the call after the American organization announced the end of its operations in Gaza. Hamas said the GHF contributed to the daily massacres of starving Palestinians and those seeking aid. It added that the foundation and those responsible for it must be held accountable for their crimes to prevent the recurrence of such tragedies and protect humanity from organized international terrorism. The movement asserted that since its entry into Gaza, the foundation acted as part of the occupying regime's security apparatus. It said the GHF used aid distribution methods that had no relation to humanitarian work and created degrading conditions for civilians just trying to access food. Hamas stressed that the foundation's methods resulted in thousands of deaths and injuries due to sniper fire and deliberate killings, making it complicit in the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling joined us earlier to share his insight on the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and its complicity in the Gaza genocide.
At last, we see the back of this foundation. I think it's interesting that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation uses this kind of charitable status as many other organizations like the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation. These people are very much like what we have in the UK, trusts. And the idea is that they're a charitable organisation. They're not for profit. But in this case, they're for killing. I'd just like to point out that there are 2,600 dead and injured people who were trying to access the Gaza so-called Humanitarian Foundation's facilities, which had been forced to take over because the Israelis, the Americans and the British and everybody else supporting the genocide was preventing UNRWA from doing their job, the United Nations, that is. And so, thankfully, this organisation is no more. One of their leaders, John Acree, I noticed, he was saying that what a wonderful job we did. He denied that any had been killed, so 2,600 dead and injured. He just was looking the other way. He didn't notice it. And actually, there were snipers, as you said, were actually killing people as they came towards the aid. So it was almost like a killing trap that you might set for a rat or an animal. That's what the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was, and so it's good to see the back of it.
Well, Palestinian towns and refugee camps in the occupied West Bank witnessed more deaths and destruction as Israeli forces press ahead with their deadly raids. In one of the latest incidents, a Palestinian young man was killed in an attack by the regime forces in Nablus. The new fatality came after earlier in the day, a Palestinian youth was killed after being shot by Israeli forces in a raid on the village of Deir Jarir, northeast of Ramallah. Another Palestinian young man from the city of Doura, south of Al-Khalil, was also killed after being brutally beaten by the regime's forces. Israeli forces also raided the towns of Anin and Maithalun, west and south of Jenin, respectively. According to local sources, Israeli forces attacked Anin, deployed its troops on its streets, abducted several young men, and confiscated surveillance cameras from several commercial shops. Well, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has issued a statement strongly condemning Israel's savage assassination of senior Hezbollah commander Haytham Ali al-Tabtabai. The IRGC stressed that the regime's cowardly terrorist act during the so-called ceasefire is not a show of strength, but proof to its weakness and desperation. The statement expressed deep regret over the silence and inaction of international and human rights institutions on Israel's genocide and savage actions, and Washington's support for the regime. It emphasized that contrary to what the U.S., Israel, and their criminal allies dream of, the resistance remains alive and dynamic. The IRGC stressed that the resistance axis and Hezbollah reserve the right to avenge their fighters and commanders in due time, with a crushing response that the terrorist aggressor regime will not expect. Well, now going back to the occupied West Bank, we are joined by Naqa Hamad, our correspondent there, joining us from Ramallah with the latest. Naqa, I'd like you please to give us any details and updates you have in regards, of course, to these Palestinians who have been recently killed. And, of course, we're having reports now that the situation in Jenin, I believe, is there's right now, they're saying that the Al-Quds Brigades is saying that their fighters are engaged in fierce battles with the IOF currently there. What is going on the ground, Naqa?
Yes, Caitlin. Well, let me start quickly by stating what's happening in the provenance of Jenin, where since the hours of the morning, the Israeli forces have been besieging the village of Mirka to the north of occupied Jenin. This village have been attacked yesterday, and a home over there have been besieged. Three brothers have been arrested from inside that home. But in the hours of the morning, the Israeli forces, after withdrawing for several hours, they have came back to that village besieging another home, but now accompanied by Apache aircrafts hovering in the skies of Mirka and in the skies of Jenin. For years, the Palestinians have not seen, in the occupied West Bank, of course, have not seen the Israeli military aircrafts in the air, especially the Apache, as it has not been participating in combat for since 2018, and now it has came again to the skies of Jenin. Until this moment, according to both local resources and the Israeli forces radio, they are talking about a heavy armed clash, clashes inside the village, and of course this comes along with the Israeli forces shouting in loudspeakers to the Palestinians, to the Palestinian fighters, to hand themselves towards the Israeli forces. One rocket of the Apache have been fired. Until this moment, no concrete information whether it targeted a car or an agricultural facility in the area that is being besieged in Mirka, which is the village to the north of occupied Jenin, that the main theater of events is taking place since the hours of the morning. Well, the rest of the West Bank is not having their calm moments. In Nablus, the Palestinians are still dealing with the retaliatory incidents that took place inside after the Israeli forces withdrawn from inside the Nablus city after assassinating a Palestinian fighter and detaining his body. Until this moment, we are almost closing to 24 hours without a formal recognition about the identity of this Palestinian who have fighted for the last breath of his life. But according to the Israeli forces, they are saying that this Palestinian have conducted a resistance-related operation later in 2024, early May in 2024, killing two Israeli soldiers on the cross point of Awarta to the east of occupied Nablus. In Ramallah over here, the Palestinians are getting ready to bid their last farewell to the Palestinian martyr of the village of Deir Jarir, Bara Ma'ali, the Palestinian young man, the Birzeit student, a university student over here. It is quite a sad farewell to that young man who paid his life to defend his land against the repeated settler attacks towards that area. Settlers also have not attacked only Deir Jarir, but also the attacks of the settlers have been all over the West Bank. All over the West Bank, settlers are wandering freely and unfortunately putting a heavy weight, especially to the area of Masafer Yatta, to the south of occupied Al-Khalil.
Thank you very much for those updates. Our correspondent, everyone, Naqa Hamad, joining us from Ramallah. Well, Iran's parliament speaker has slammed Israel's killing of senior Hezbollah commander Haysam Ali al-Tabatabai, calling for actions to stop the Tel Aviv regime's acts of aggression in the region.
The criminal Zionist regime has expanded its aggression across the region. The only way to ensure regional stability is to cut the aggressor's hand.
The resistance, not only in Lebanon, but throughout the region, will address this sensitive issue in a coordinated, coherent manner and with prudence. The resistance will also act courageously.
Khalibov said Israel and its criminal prime minister have formed an international criminal gang and pursues a strategy of aggression with no limits. He criticized some Western countries and international institutions for their failure to stop the Israeli crimes. Khalibov warned that the situation cannot continue and patience won't last. He said Israel doesn't abide by any agreement and is seeking escalation in the entire region. Iran's top security official is in Pakistan's capital Islamabad in a visit aimed at boosting ties between the two neighbors. Ali Larajani, who is the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, held a meeting with Pakistani Foreign Minister and Deputy Prime Minister Mohammad Ishaq Dar. In the meeting, Larajani called for an increase in economic transactions between Tehran and Islamabad, saying the volume of annual trade should reach $10 billion. Earlier, upon landing in Islamabad, the Iranian official said relations between the two countries can help promote regional peace and stability. Larajani is in Pakistan on a two-day visit. He is set to meet with other military and government officials. Well, the Taliban-led government in Afghanistan says Pakistani airstrikes have killed at least 9 children and a woman in the Khost region and province. The Taliban spokesman said attacks were also carried out in the provinces of Kunar and Paktika, leaving 4 civilians injured. Islamabad has yet to comment on the strikes. The strikes came just a day after twin suicide bombings in Pakistan's Peshawar killed 3 paramilitary personnel. Tensions between the two neighbors have been escalating since October. A ceasefire was signed in Doha last month, but peace talks in Turkey collapsed soon after, with both sides failing to reach agreement over militant groups operating inside Afghanistan. A new survey in the U.S. shows rising pessimism among Latinos under the Trump administration. The Pew Research Center says 70% of Latinos disapprove of the way Trump is handling his job as president. Over 2/3 of them are also critical of the administration's approach to immigration. According to a separate survey conducted by Axios Ipsos, some 65% of respondents say it's a bad time to be Latino or Hispanic in the U.S. Since Trump came to office in his second term, crackdown against immigrants has worsened. Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
We will try to make some effort to get a little, to know a little bit more about the station of our mother, Sayyida Zahra. The station of our mother with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not something that you and I, we can grasp fully. I'm going to mention some of the ahadith. We'll talk about it. But again, this is much, much less than the reality. It's just that we're looking in that direction. We're hoping that Allah can show us a little bit about the station of our mother. I'm going to be taking some ahadith that have been mentioned by Shia and Sunni. There's some of them that have been mentioned, direct quotes from our Sunni brothers. Some of them are from Shia sources. Together trying to paint this picture to see a little bit about who she is and the preparation that took place for a night like this or a day like this. Right. We're celebrating her birth, but tonight we'll be talking a little bit about what went into her birth and her coming into this world. So first, we'll start off by talking a little bit about our Prophet. Brothers and sisters, if we want to understand the station of Sayyida Fatima, let's remember that her father is undeniably and unquestionably the best of Allah's creation. Not just the greatest of the messengers of Allah, but the best of Allah's creation to ever set foot on the earth. If you look in some of our hadith, they say, أَوَّلُ مَا خَلَقَ اللَّهُ, the first thing that God ever made, نُورِ, was the nur of Muhammad. Amirul Mu'mineen, again for us to understand what went into her birth. Amirul Mu'mineen, who we know is the first of the Muslims, who slept in the bed of the Prophet, who in order for the Prophet to be able to immigrate properly, he slept in the bed of the Prophet. He was there in the Battle of Khaybar, taking on Marhab, the Battle of Khandaq, taking on Amr bin Abdiwud, ripped the door off of Khaybar. What does Amirul Mu'mineen say about Rasulullah? He says, "Innama ana abdun min abidi Muhammad," that I, Ali, am nothing but a slave of Muhammad. So that's her father. When it comes to her mother, again, we're talking about one of the four best women to ever walk the earth, her mother. Just one hadith, because tonight we want to talk about Sayyida Fatima, but just again so we know the station of her mother. The Prophet told her mother this. So this is about Sayyida Khadija, the mother of Fatima. Inna Allah Azza wa Jal, truly Allah, the invincible, the majestic, La yubahi biki kirama malaikatihi kulla yawm mirara. Every day, on a daily basis, God boasts to the noble angels about you. Right? About Sayyida Khadija. Every day, God boasts to the angels that I have a wonderful servant named Khadija. That's her mother. But just that father, and again, that kind of a mother, even that's not going to be enough. There's preparation that takes place. You've heard that one of her names is that she is a human being, but at the same time, one of the Hurul'ain, right? The Prophet explains why. He says, when I went on the Mi'raj, one of the things that I did was that I partook of some of the heavenly fruit. He took of some of the fruit. That fruit that the Prophet got on the Mi'raj is what's going to be later what forms Sayyida Fatima. Even that, again, is not enough. So that kind of father, that kind of mother, Mi'raj, again, that's not enough. What happened? Angel Jibra'il descended in all of his magnificence. What that means, he came in his original form. What the hadith tell us, and again, we don't know what that means, but the hadith say that that meant that his wings expanded over the east and the west. And he came to see the prophet with a message from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So prophet at that station, Sayyidah Khadijah at that station. Even then, what he told him, he said, this is from God now. 40 days, you have to separate yourself from Khadijah. You're going to be given this ultimate gift of Sayyidah Fatima. 40 days of the prophet at that station, go worship. At the end of the 40 days of worship, we learn from some of the hadith that again the prophet was given two fruits. This time one for him and also one for Sayyidah Khadijah. The angel came back to him on the 40th day, took that fruit. Then, that is the formation of Sayyidah Fatima. During her, when she was in the womb of her mother, she's speaking to her mother. And of course, we've already heard, and I've shared with you, that when she was finally delivered into this world, so a day like today, then those women came down from heaven to assist in her delivery. So that's a little bit, again, we don't know what she's really like, but a little bit of who the station is. Now our prophet, he didn't just suffice with those ahadith about her station, her being Nur, these kind of things. Actually, what he tried to do was to show his ummah practically what her station was with God. Our prophet, the greatest of creation. So this one that I want to mention to you is mentioned in the books of our Sunni brothers, this first hadith. They say that this was the seerah of the prophet. So this means that every time the prophet would see Sayyidah Fatima, this would take place. Remember at this time, because this is one of the wives of the prophet who's speaking. So Sayyidah Fatima, let's say she's 14 years old when this happens. This is what she says. She says, "Kanat idha dakhalat alay." So whenever Sayyidah Fatima would come into the house to see the prophet, rahaba biha. The first thing the prophet would do would be to welcome her. You've heard from the other hadith that the prophet would get from where he was sitting, he would stand up and he would walk to Sayyidah Fatima, right? He would then welcome her, rahaba biha. Now, waqabbala yadayha. The prophet would bend down and kiss the hand of his daughter. Rasulullah would kiss the hands of his daughter. Wa ajlasaha fi majlisih. The other thing the prophet would do, and the wives of the prophet are watching this, the other thing is that the prophet, remember the prophet's house is as simple as you can imagine. There's like a sheepskin rug, but otherwise there's a dirt floor. The prophet would get up. He would sit in the dirt and he would have Sayyidah Fatima sit in his seat. What would happen when the prophet would go visit her? When the prophet would go visit her, this is another hadith that says, وَإِذَا جَاءَ إِلَيْهَا. So now the prophet's going to visit Sayyidah Fatima. لَقِيَتْهُ. She would obviously go meet the prophet. وَقَبَّلَ كُلُّ وَاحِدٍ مِّنْهُمَا صَاحِبَهُ. Each one would then kiss the other. The father is kissing the daughter. The daughter is kissing the father. وَجَلَسَ مَعَانٍ. Now it was different though. She would want to offer the prophet her spot. The prophet wouldn't allow that. The prophet and her would sit together.
Allahumma salli ala Fatimata wa abiha wa ba'liha wa baniha wa ba'liha wa baniha. سر المستودع فيها بعدد ما أحاط به علمك يا فاطمة يا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
That was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days from the heart of region to the global stage. God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's visit to the White House. Donald Trump has shrugged off the Saudi regime's 2018 murder of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, saying the journalist was extremely controversial and unpopular, dismissing the killing by observing things happen. The U.S. president made the remarks at the White House on Tuesday while welcoming Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for the first time since Khashoggi's murder and dismemberment in Istanbul by Saudi state operatives. Donald Trump castigated the ABC News journalist who asked a question about the murder, suggesting that ABC should lose its broadcasting license, and describing Khashoggi as extremely controversial. A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or you didn't like him, things happen. But he knew nothing about it, Trump said, referring to the Crown Prince. Prince Mohammed said, "It's painful and it's a huge mistake, and we are doing our best that this doesn't happen again." Trump sought to highlight promised Saudi investment in the U.S. economy, which was billed at the start of the White House meeting as totaling $600 billion. But which the Crown Prince said at Trump's prompting could ultimately total $1 trillion. Trump confirmed that he intended to sell top-of-the-line F-35 stealth fighter jets to Riyadh over the objections of Israel and concerns of the U.S. intelligence community. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Mehran Derakhshand.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, why is Trump insisting that Mohammed bin Salman knows nothing about Khashoggi's murder, even though U.S. intelligence agencies confirmed at the time that the Saudi Crown Prince had ordered the killing?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, effectively, Donald Trump is contradicting his own intelligence agencies, which confirmed at the time that, indeed, the Saudi Crown Prince had ordered the killing of this dissident journalist, Jamal Khashoggi. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Trump fiercely defended Mohammed bin Salman, insisting that he did not know about the murder in 2018. As the old saying goes, money talks, and the Crown Prince's huge wealth and his willingness to invest colossal sums of money in the U.S. Mm-hmm. economy is probably the reason why Donald Trump is insisting that he knew nothing about Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Mm-hmm. The controversy over the killing of Khashoggi, who was a Washington Post columnist, a critic of the Saudi leadership, has once again flared because 7 years after his murder, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has visited the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And Mohammed bin Salman is now trying to rehabilitate his global image, which was tarnished by the murder of this dissident journalist.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I think the huge sums of money which bin Salman is investing in the U.S. economy is the reason why Trump is insisting he knew nothing mm-hmm. about the murder.
Yeah. Confirmed that he intended to sell top-of-the-line F-35 stealth fighter jet to Riyadh over the objections of Israel and concerns of the U.S. intelligence community. What are these concerns?
Yes, that's right. There are many concerns about the sale of these F-35 stealth fighter jets to Saudi Arabia. One of the main concerns is that U.S. intelligence agencies have been alarmed because Saudi Arabia has a close security ties with China. And selling these F-35 stealth fighter jets to Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. could mean that there might be possible theft of F-35's technology by China because the Chinese and the Saudi Arabians have close ties, security ties, and it could be that some of the very sensitive technology mm-hmm. used in these F-35 stealth fighter jets might end up in Chinese hands.
Right.
Now, another concern has been raised by the Israeli regime. Israel currently is the only entity in the Middle East which has these advanced planes.
True.
And the Israelis are worried about losing their air power superiority. So mm-hmm. this is another point. Israel is worried about losing its air power superiority if Donald Trump sells these stealth fighter jets to Saudi Arabia. And Trump himself has insisted that he was prepared to sell these fighter planes to Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, he said, when you look at the F-35 and you're asking me, is it the same? I think it's going to be pretty similar. This is he said, Israel is a great ally of the United States and Saudi Arabia is another great ally. Mm-hmm. And I know that the Saudis don't want inferior planes to the Israelis. So he says, as far as I'm concerned, I think they're both at a level that they should get. Both of them should get top of the line. So mm-hmm. Trump is suggesting that the planes which are about to be sold to Saudi Arabia are about the same as the planes already sold to Israel. Mm-hmm. So that's that.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has reportedly canceled his meeting with U.S. senators this week over concerns about who might show up. Tell us more about that.
Yes, it wasn't actually... There were quite a few Democratic senators mm-hmm. who were very critical of Mohammed bin Salman's visit to the White House. But there was also a number of Republicans who were very critical as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, we have the Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders referring to Mohammed bin Salman. He said, this is a dictator who had a U.S. columnist murdered for criticizing the Saudi royal family.
Mm-hmm.
And Bernie Sanders added, sadly, we have a president who prefers the Saudi model, an autocracy run by a trillionaire family, to democracy.
Yeah, right.
So that was just one comment by the top Democratic and Senator, actually independent and Democratic Senator mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders. But the point is that Mohammed bin Salman has offered to pledge at least $600 billion of investment in the United States.
Yeah.
And... on Wednesday, he was due to meet with a group of senators on Capitol Hill to further ties between Riyadh and Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But this meeting was abruptly called off because of his concerns about who might turn up. So there was this concern about Senator Bernie Sanders, a Democratic senator, another senator, Ed Markey, another Democratic senator, and also mm-hmm. Republican senators like Lindsey Graham. He was also worried about Republican Senator Lindsey Graham turning up.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was the reason why it was abruptly called off.
I see, Democrats fumed over the Crown Prince trip to the White House, particularly over the CIA's 2018 conclusion that Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of Khashoggi. Tell us about some of the comments made by Democratic senators.
Yes. Well, for example, we had the Democratic Senator from Massachusetts, Ed Markey.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Trump says he will sell our most advanced fighter jet to the Saudis, who U.S. intelligence agency says killed journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Democratic Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts said, looks like Saudi Arabia's billion-dollar business deals with the Trump family are paying off. And this is outrageous, he said.
Mm-hmm.
So another comment was from Bernie Sanders, independent senator with Democratic leaning, independent senator Bernie Sanders, who said, sadly, we have a president who prefers the Saudi model, an autocracy run by a trillionaire family, to democracy. And there were also a few critics of the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, among the Republicans, in particular Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. He slammed the Saudi government back in 2018 when the murder occurred of Jamal Khashoggi. At the time, Bernie Sanders called Mohammed bin Salman toxic and a wrecking ball.
Mm-hmm.
He said the U.S. should sanction the hell out of Saudi Arabia. That was back in 2018. He said the U.S. should sanction the hell out of Saudi Arabia. And he also vowed never to work with Mohammed bin Salman as long as he remains the leader of Saudi Arabia. So these are just some of the comments by both Republican and Democratic senators.
Mm-hmm. Listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. Salman's visit to Washington is also controversial because of the blurred lines between the Trump family's private business interests and the Persian Gulf. Tell us more about that.
Yes, well, President Trump tried to reassure his audience that he had relinquished control of his business empire. Effectively, he said, I have nothing to do with the family business. I have left and I've devoted 100% of my energy to the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what my family does is fine. They do business all over the world. They've done very little business with Saudi Arabia, actually.
Yeah.
I'm sure they could do a lot more. And anything they've done has been very good.
Mm-hmm.
But when Donald Trump took office for his second term in office, during his second term in the White House, the Trump Organization announced he would step back from day-to-day management of his business in New York, and his assets will be placed in a trust
mm-hmm.
managed by his children.
I see.
However, critics have said that President Trump should either divest from the business completely or put his assets in a blind trust, not a trust controlled by his children.
Mm-hmm.
During his second term, the Trump family business has entered extensive negotiations over multi-billion dollar investments in Saudi Arabia, and this is what has blurred the line, because we don't know how much of that is actually Trump's family fortune, how much is that his private
mm-hmm.
money, and how much of that is U.S. taxpayer money.
Exactly.
So the lines mm-hmm. are blurred there. And also President Trump announced during the visit that he declared Saudi Arabia a major non-NATO ally of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he said this is very important. Trump confirmed that U.S. will sell F-35 fighter jets to Saudi Arabia. And he also said this move will deepen military cooperation and strengthen one of Washington's closest partnerships in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And he also talked about historic strategic defense agreement between Washington and
mm-hmm.
Riyadh. So these were the main points. But there is quite a lot of concern in Washington about the fact that some of this multi-billion dollar investments by Saudi Arabia in Washington and vice versa, by multi-billion dollar deals which Donald Trump has been making with Saudi Arabia, some of that is his own private money,
right.
Others is U.S. taxpayer money.
Yeah.
So the lines are a bit blurred here as to which is which.
Yeah, it's not clear. To sum up very briefly then, Trump's insistence that Mohammed bin Salman knew nothing about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi is because bin Salman has agreed to invest hundreds of billions of dollars in the U.S. economy. Thank you, Mr. Rashander, for your insightful analysis.
Thanks for inviting me.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
حضرت فاطمة عليها السلام is the role model for women throughout history and for all Referring to the qualities of Hazrat Fatima alayhi salam, Ayatollah Khamenei says, A multidimensional human being, a brave warrior in the way of Islam, a knowledgeable lady who at the same time played her role as a housewife and affectionate wife and mother to perfection, such was Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayhi salam. Her life was very simple, and she had very frugal needs or expectations. Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayha salam was the best exemplar for all women, and Muslims should learn from her. Hazrat Zahra alayha salam proved that, like men, a woman too can reach the most sublime levels of ethics and worship on the mystical path. The very existence of Hazrat Zahra alayha salam, along with her skills of eloquence, her political and social expertise, and powerful foresight, demonstrates how a Muslim woman can attain high spiritual and mystical positions at a young age. A role model such as this great personality, Muslim women should never feel weak or helpless, but should in fact gather more awareness about the high status that Islam grants to women. A study of life of this great lady would clearly show us that the path to ascension is wide open for every woman. In fact, it is Hazrat Fatima Zahra alayhi salam who has already trodden that path and is a guide for other women to follow. Hazrat Fatima was like a bright light in the lives of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam and Imam Ali alayhi salam. This is natural that taking her as a role model would be very beneficial for Muslim women. Declaring the birthday of Hazrat Zahra alayhi salam as Women's Day, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "If you don't learn from her asceticism, piety, modesty, and other virtues, you have not even understood the true essence of womanhood." Hazrat Fatima alayha salam was a very knowledgeable person, a fact that was acknowledged by friends and foes alike. In fact, from time to time, she would make herself available for people who needed answers or clarifications on difficult and complicated issues. Her sermons, poems and sayings are evidence of her intellectual strength of character and nobility of mind. She was an embodiment of all virtues of womanhood. She was an exemplary daughter, a loving and supporting wife, a caring mother, and a powerful and aware member of the society.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to all our listeners from around the world. I hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning, and this is our schedule. We start tonight's lineup with today's special, a special daily mixed format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. That will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. And to round up this hour's program, we have our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today.